But thank you, everyone, for coming, and especially thank you for the students and the staff who worked really hard to make this day very gratifying for Colleen and I. So there's a lot of people. There's an astonishing amount of work that went into having these beautiful folders and cookies and microphones and everything that we have today that made this a nice event. So I really want to thank everyone who helped us, because it certainly was not me, I can assure you of that. So many of the issues that come up with this last panel have really come up already today, several times. One of the things that I think exemplifies the problems that we're dealing with when we think about access for poor people is really, pretty close outside our doors. This morning on my way in, Sid Yu, who's one of the staff here, reminded me of the sign that was down right outside our front door, which is my prop. And what this is, if anyone here needs insurance, you just have to call 288-3400. And I will put this back in the ground when I'm done. Now, within a short bicycle
ride... You're violating
ride,
all sorts of CME regulations by doing this, you know.
I'm sure I am. That won't be the first regulations that I've violated today, I'm sure. Within a short bicycle ride of where we are right now, there are probably 200,000 people who don't have insurance or who are underinsured. Probably, at least if Colleen were riding the bike. I think if I were doing it, it'd be more like 50,000. But, we don't have to... We don't have to go far to see the problem. In moderating the panel today, I'll tell you at least two issues that brought me to this. For the past 5 years, I've been taking care of an adult with disabilities who is on Medicaid and has a variety of problems, and we've gotten to wait in social service agencies and ERs in Chicago and had the indignity of being turned away when doctors discover that this person's a Medicaid recipient, even though he's accompanied by a guy in a suit and a tie. There really is something about getting calls from collection agencies and inscrutable bills for six-figure amounts that Medicaid is paying that both makes you very grateful that social insurance programs are out there, but also makes you wish that they worked more comprehensively, more competently, and more humanely for the people who receive them. Jim mentioned, we are our brother's keepers because we are our brother's brothers. Of course, there are keepers too. And I think that we often have these conversations with the assumption that we are the keepers. And one of the great arguments for social insurance is that we can protect ourselves by banding together. Did the microphone just die out on me? Did I say something? My second experience was really working in the campaign this year. I've never been involved in a presidential campaign. I did a lot of door-to-door work. And one of the things that really struck me were many of the people that I met. In sort of true community organizer fashion, I went around to a lot of garage sales and talked to people, which was just a nicer way to approach people than sort of knocking as a stranger on their door, where they're a little worried you're some sort of a... they're not so worried if you're a kook, it's if you're a nut that really worries them. If you're eccentric, that's okay. But I went to one garage sale, and there's a little sign up that just said, all proceeds go to liver transplant patients. And this is somewhere in western Indiana. And the son-in-law of the person holding the garage sale is a man with liver disease who's getting actually excellent medical care, but he needs a liver transplant, and he's in the two-year waiting period. He's been deemed disabled, but he has a two-year waiting period before he receives his Medicare benefits as part of the way SSDI works as a social program, and he's going medically bankrupt. And, I paid $20 for my cup of coffee, and I tried to be a little bit helpful, but life moves on, and there's just a lot of people out there like that, and we're spending $2.4 trillion, and we just do not treat people decently. And one of the real benefits of retail politics is that you really see that every day. We're talking to people. There's an One of my jobs as a campaign volunteer was to help test the phone system sometime in late 2007. I went downtown to Chicago, and I was calling rural South Carolina, calling African-American people. You couldn't imagine more boundaries of sort of race, age, education, culture, geography that I was crossing. And people were very enthusiastic to talk, actually. There's one man I called, and he started telling me in great, couldn't have been more enthusiastic. You know, he was definitely one of those voters that you put the little positive check on as far as, is he going to vote for my guy? But he started describing his health problems and his wife's health problems. And he said, you know, what are you going to do to help me? And there was a kind of, and it wasn't like, send me a white paper about what you think about the individual mandate. It was just this very direct and innocent, if your guy wins, what is going to happen right now to help me in my very difficult situation? And it was almost like getting a punch in the stomach, because I really didn't know what I could say to that man. And, you know, Jim mentioned the need for speed as a sort of political and strategic imperative. It's more than that. It's really, there's a lot of people out there who are really pretty desperate. excuse me. So I think everyone who lives and works in the South Side of Chicago probably has very similar stories to the ones that I just told. Certainly anybody who works in healthcare. But it's a serious bit of business, and I think we often can lose the human face that is behind the imperative for health reform, because we have to also grapple with the institutional complexities, the financing structures, and the PSRO type level of detail that actually needs to be attended to, if not by the president, by someone. So, well, we have two people today who are really superbly equipped to talk about many of the tensions that we face, and I'll introduce them both now, and then we'll let them speak. Greg Block will go first. Greg and I, by the way, we met electronically during the campaign, and I think we violated all eight of the injunctions that Jim Marrone identified as sort of the political. Hopefully we didn't violate them all, but we might have. I certainly did. Greg is an accomplished physician and legal researcher, and he's currently visiting the law school here, but he has quite an array of affiliations at Georgetown University. He's been affiliated with Brookings, and he also teaches public health at Johns Hopkins, so he's carries quite the number of hats. He writes with great reflective intelligence about a variety of ethical and policy issues that reflect his expertise. If you read the New England Journal of Medicine, you'll see he's often a commentator in JAMA, New England Journal, many health policy journals. And so I'm really looking forward to what Greg has to say. Stacy Lindau, I'm also really looking forward to hearing from. Stacy is... has quite an amazing trajectory as a physician researcher at sort of the interface between medical research and survey research, and the use of biomarkers to learn some really important things about populations of people. And she's a great expert on adult sexuality. So I'm very grateful that if my mom calls me with a question, I sort of have someone to refer her to. They're, I'm sure you appreciated that one. The thing that I really most admire about Stacy is the work that she's doing now as the principal investigators for the Southside Health and Vitality Studies. This is really a really important effort that the University of Chicago is doing, and Stacy has managed with great energy and intelligence this effort in a difficult time. I sort of think of Lyndon Johnson, you know, with Wilbur Mills. That, I think that's sort of what is required in some of these studies that require all these community partners and university partners to come together. So anyway, with that obsequious introduction, I'll now sit down and let Greg and Stacy take it away.
Yeah, I guess you could say Harold Whitaker. Thanks. Thanks, Colleen and Harold, for inviting me. I think I'm mainly enthusiastic about being on this panel for the chance to hear what Stacy has to say. But I apologize in advance because I have a flight back. I'm a weekly commuter, and I have a flight back to Washington for which I have to bolt. I have to be in a cab at 4:40. So at least from here, I can see my cab coming up, and maybe I can see him driving away, and then I'll really get nervous. My goal today is, number one, to pretend I'm a New Yorker and talk fast. And number two, to offer some ideas about how legal governance both stands in the way of health reform and might contribute towards making decent health care available for all of us at a cost that we can handle. Our health care system is fast becoming the physical equivalent of global warming. Even as Americans lose their jobs and their medical coverage at an alarming rate, even as the number of uninsured approaches 50 million, we're on track towards spending 50% of our GDP on medical care before this century comes to an end. So says the CBO, which points out the obvious, that we're not really going to spend 50% of GDP on health care, that something is going to have to change. We'll somehow have to bend the curve of rising costs downward in a major way, even as we face this challenge of insuring 50 million people. Can the law that governs health care provision help us to do so without leaving tens of millions of people behind, without access to decent minimum of care, and without cutting back on care senselessly with little regard for comparative clinical benefit? Standard wisdom amongst us law professor types holds that health law is ill-suited to do so, that health law is a big part of the problem. American health law is a chaotic and incomplete patchwork created by 50 state court systems, 12 federal circuits that act in disconnected fashion, knowing almost nothing about health policy, 50 state legislatures and sets of regulatory agencies, and, well, you get the picture. Multiple doctrines are at war with each other. Core values are in sharp conflict, and bitter disagreement over the basics of what health reform should accomplish has paralyzed our politics as well as our courts and judges. And yet commentary on health law typically presumes the existence of key decision makers with top-down authority over the law in their domains, authority they can wield to yield to impose a single overarching vision. Commentators in this area typically speak about what those decision makers should do without regard for whether these decision makers exist. And my central claim is that such commentary overlooks healthcare law's central dilemma, its astonishing degree of fragmentation. Instead of railing against this fragmentation and calling for some imagined homunculus-type actor to fix the problems in top-down fashion, health law scholars and practitioners need to come to terms with the field's fragmentation. And to this end, I'll offer some thoughts about how aspiring reformers ought to navigate this fragmentation and perhaps even turn health law's contradictory impulses toward reformist ends. In most fields of law, this isn't a problem. You have the U.S. Supreme Court and constitutional law, or perhaps certain regulatory agencies like the FCC or the SEC within their spheres of endeavor. But health law doesn't function this way because no single authority sets the rules or is in a position to implement the proposals and paradigms urged by commentators. Health law is the product of many scattered deciders who act not in concert but in interdependent fashion. These scattered deciders hold multiple clashing understandings of what legal governance ought to aim to accomplish. And no single understanding is likely to prevail. And so health law, I suggest, exhibits the properties of an emergent system, a system with a design that arises from ongoing feedback amongst these scattered deciders. Its design or its intelligence transcends these deciders. Indeed, it's a common feature of emergent systems that their component elements do their part absent awareness of their places in the larger scheme. Our neurons, for example, sum up electrical signals and then fire to activate or suppress follow-on cells that participate in networks tied to perceiving and understanding the world. And neurons, of course, have no sense of their larger networking mission. They just follow the laws of chemistry and physics. The logic of our thoughts and behavior emerges from this. The design of cities and societies and economies likewise emerges from the motives and actions of individuals who think they know what they're doing, but who are mostly unaware of their roles in fashioning and sustaining neighborhoods and subcultures and industries, or the other social forms that organize our lives. And we're, of course, different from neurons or ants in an anthill. We're more flexible because our neural networks evolve in response to events, and we're more hierarchical, and sometimes we're even more self-aware. But what we have in common with our remote six-legged ant and bee relatives and our neurons is that the intelligence of our social forms transcends our sense while in the fray of our motives and judgments and actions. The logic of American healthcare governance, I submit, is similarly emergent, for better and often for worse. I'm going to do some trimming here because of time, but I'll give one example. The tension between malpractice laws, reliance upon professional standards of care, and the proposition that markets ought to let consumers pick from among different levels of care, an idea which is embodied in antitrust doctrine and to some degree in judicial interpretation of health insurance contracts. Commentators on health care law treat this tension as a failure of coherence. Market-oriented commentators complain that liability for breach of professional standards prevents health plans and providers from offering lower-cost care and coverage options. And liberals who object to tying medical care to ability to pay defend professional standards as a floor below which levels of care shouldn't fall. Looking at health law as an emergent system yields a different understanding, one that treats this apparent incoherence as a channel for feedback among scattered deciders with differing perspectives. A deeply felt commitment to health equity and the ideal of life's pricelessness animates tort law's deference to professional standards. Were the law to utterly abandon its reliance on professional standards, it would detach itself from these concerns. And this might undermine people's beliefs in law's responsiveness to their hopes and fears. Yet, of course, life isn't priceless. The market price of life is probably about $100,000 per quality-adjusted life year. That's what we teach, at least, in that building a few blocks down. Resources are scarce, and Americans revere the market as the most efficient, least authoritarian way to manage scarcity. Antitrust and other doctrines that promote consumer choice in healthcare express this. The legal regimes that govern medical malpractice and restraints on competition thus embody different suites of concerns to which Americans are inextricably committed, even as these suites of concerns contradict. But from an emergent systems perspective, this isn't really a contradiction. It's an opportunity for mutual feedback among component systems that constitute health law. So antitrust lawyers who take a combative stance toward professional standards can stay true to their convictions, as can egalitarians who see healthcare allocation based on ability to pay as anathema. Both sides, of course, think they know what they're doing, campaigning to make healthcare more consistent and to get it right by cleansing it of the pernicious influence of the opposing view. Both sides, meanwhile, participate in a larger process of which they may be only dimly aware, a process of feedback between legal schemes that sometimes sustains existing arrangements and that at other times pushes healthcare governance hard in one direction or another, as scattered deciders take account of developments in neighboring suites of law. There are lots of other examples of feedback schemes like this in healthcare law, and I have a piece forthcoming in the Southern Cal Law Review, which develops a lot of these examples. What these feedback schemes do is enable the expression of values and concerns that are at odds with each other, but deeply felt, to the point that health law cannot realistically discard them. Legal and regulatory actions that offend these values inspire responses from the losing parties and from legal decision makers with different perspectives. Decision makers charged with implementing different legal regimes toward a contract or ERISA or antitrust or many others send negative or positive feedback signals through their responses. And out of these many interwoven networks of deciders, healthcare's legal governance emerges. And this self-organizing process doesn't guarantee a governance system that works well. And by way of analogy, emergence in biological systems creates tumors and seizures and other phenomena that careen out of control when these feedback mechanisms that maintain homeostasis fail. And of course, our worsening crises of cost and access, clinical mistakes that kill tens of thousands per year, and the proliferation of treatments absent proof of their value strongly suggest that in healthcare governance, lots has gone awry. How to intervene to make healthcare's governance part of the solution is a question, I submit, that calls for the logic of emergence. Given our time constraints, I'm not going to say much about how we might intervene. I'd be glad to make the paper available. I have a draft of it now if anybody wants to see it. But I want to close, given the time constraints and the hope for having some discussion, I want to close with an observation about the power that this kind of insight has had when exercised by those who have been opposed to healthcare reform. And I am leaping ahead in my notes as we speak here. So, here we go. All right, here we go. So since the enactment of Medicare and Medicaid, opponents of publicly sponsored universal coverage have displayed a deeper intuitive awareness of the dynamics of emergence than have advocates of health insurance for all. A stunning example played out back in 1993 as congressional Republicans scrambled to prepare for President Clinton's anticipated health reform juggernaut. At first, the party's House and Senate leaders weighed plausible compromises like the Chafee Plan, if you remember the Chafee Plan. And Senator Dole talked, the minority leader talked about making some sort of deal along the lines of the Chafee Plan. And these compromises might have achieved near universal coverage with a reduced role for government. These compromises hewed to traditional Republican principles. They would have left open a wide playing field for competition between health plans, minimally restricted by federal regulators. But conservative strategist William Kristol looked beyond the policy logic of the possible deals toward the longer-term implications of government-guaranteed coverage. For Republicans, he intuited, the implications were disastrous. Enactment of any publicly financed scheme to cover all would rekindle Roosevelt-era confidence in government as guarantor of personal security, undermining the broader Republican case for taxes, for lower taxes and less government. And conversely, defeat for health reform on President Clinton's watch would deliver a lasting blow to Americans' belief in government's ability to solve complex social problems and to confidence in Democrats' ability to deliver on their promises. And so in a memo that quickly achieved iconic status among conservatives, Kristol urged Republicans to go all out to kill healthcare reform. There should be no deals, no carefully nuanced compromises, Kristol argued. The Clinton plan should come to nothing except disillusionment. Swayed by Kristol's analysis, House and Senate Republican leaders abandoned compromise alternatives in favor of a scorched earth stance toward healthcare reform. And by the fall of 1994, the Clinton plan had succumbed. Just a few months later, disillusioned voters delivered both houses of Congress to the Republicans for the first time in 40 years. Universal coverage disappeared from the national agenda for about a decade, during which time the ranks of the uninsured grew by about a million a year. And more than that, and more importantly for Kristol, Americans maintained their skepticism toward government's ability to transform their lives for the better through grand social policy schemes. Kristol had gotten it right by thinking preternaturally in emergent systems fashion. Until perhaps 2009, suddenly out of sheer terror, Americans are looking to government with large expectations. Fear, if great enough, will cause distrust to succumb. The conventional story right now is that the cost of financial rescue is going to rule out comprehensive health reform, including universal coverage. And I suggest that the opposite is the case, that government's sudden large involvement in finance will transform America's sense of what the state should attempt in healthcare and other spheres. And so I'm optimistic about the possibility of a large leap towards universal coverage. The approach is now being considered by congressional Democrats and the Obama administration show an acute sensitivity to the dynamics of emergence. The organizing principle behind these approaches is the importance of minimizing disruption of established arrangements and settled expectations. To this end, these proposals leave employment-based coverage in place. They pursue universal coverage by expanding current public programs and by subsidizing middle-income Americans' purchase of private insurance. They avoid extending Medicaid and SCHIP to people at income levels that are within the marketing sites of private insurers, since doing so would arouse strong insurance company opposition. And the subsidies they promise for the purchase of private coverage are a multi-billion-dollar benefit for insurers. So there's only one likely near-term group of losers, the employers who don't now provide coverage, who would have to choose between offering insurance and paying a tax or fee to support the public subsidies. Massachusetts tried to make this problem go away by having a minimum fee, the $295 a year, but a federal system would not be able to survive financially by taking the Massachusetts a political dodge on this front. So these reform plans would build momentum for universal coverage by leveraging some existing arrangements and minimizing disruption to others. On the other hand, they open pathways to long-term fundamental changes. The insurance exchanges they'd established to pool risk create the possibility of an economically viable alternative to workplace-based coverage. Workplace-based coverage is kind of the Rodney Dangerfield of health insurance. It gets no respect except that nobody can figure out a better way that doesn't cause catastrophic disruption to pool risk. But over time, this alternative purchasing mechanism could eclipse the workplace as America's main source for private insurance. The insurance exchange mechanism creates an alternative pooling process that could develop. Ironically, achieving one of the goals that some proponents of the John McCain health plan urged in trying to get us away from employment-based coverage. And it's interesting that the Obama administration has looked with some interest at the possibility of capping the tax deduction for contributions to premiums. It's an idea which was, of course, anathema during the campaign for understandable political reasons. So there are lots of things that could emerge. I submit that a central challenge, as illustrated by the collapse of health reform in California, is dealing with the interwoven networks of cross-subsidies that healthcare institutions survive on today, whether we're talking about little flows like the Medicare disproportionate share subsidy or the tax deduction for not-for-profit hospitals, the so-called charitable exemption for institutions that provide no significant amount of charity. All of these things are embedded subsidies that are very difficult to disrupt. And that in general, I submit reformers should leave these things more or less in place just because it's not worth starting up a fight. We have a kind of natural psychology of loss aversion. Individuals do, so do bureaucrats. And you don't want to tell any institution that you're cutting off its subsidy until you first show persuasively that there's an alternative subsidy flowing to replace it. The article I mentioned, it's called The Emergent Logic of Health Law, coming out in Southern California Law Review, goes into this in more detail. I'm going to stop at this point. Maybe there'll be even time for some chatter. Thank you very much.
Well, it's Friday afternoon. It appears to be the first day of spring. It's cocktail hour. And we have social – raise your hand if you're a social worker. And a physician, And other? So what are the others?
Psychologists.
Sociologists. Nursing. Public health students. Okay, well, we have a diverse crowd. How many people actively take care of patients or provide direct services to people? Fewer than I expected. I'm glad I asked. And how many of you would say that the predominance of your practice involves caring for people who are poor or uninsured? So almost everybody who's providing care would say that they're predominantly providing care to people who are underserved. Okay, well, now I know who I'm talking to. And because my reputation is, I'm most infamously known as being a geriatric sex researcher. And since it's Friday and cocktail hour, I'm going to start by talking a little bit about that. So you try to make the link between me and Greg. Best of luck. He's a psychiatrist, so psychiatrists are interested in sex too. But that's about as close as I can get to a link. So I regret to tell you that I am not an expert necessarily on the subject of what is the obligation of physicians to care for the poor. And I'm going to use the term physicians because that's what I am, but I think many of the experiences and insights here would relate to others who are clinicians. So I'm not an expert on the literature, and I come today from the perspective of a physician who's been practicing medicine, gynecology specifically, on the south side of Chicago since the turn of this century. I practiced at the Friend Family Health Center, a federally qualified public health center where I cared almost exclusively for low-income women and girls who are not eligible for care elsewhere. And then I moved to work at the University Student Health Center where I cared almost exclusively for, as you would presume, university students. Now, university students are not necessarily what we would call poor in the traditional sense. They're poor in simulated fashion, typically one phone call away from additional resources. But they do take their financial independence quite seriously, and I've seen many students sacrifice, forego, or delay recommended medical care due to cost concerns, either time or money. Students also have a habit of self-medication for things like stress, and I also saw this in the community. My current clinical practice focuses on addressing the problems related to sexual functioning among women and girls who've been treated for cancer. So it's a very narrow clinical focus. That part of my clinical work happens at the Academic Medical Center, and there's a large literature about the relationship between the Academic Medical Center and poor communities and what the obligations of the Academic Medical Center might be to the poor. There in that practice, I see women who have had surgeries that remove their breasts, that remove their gynecologic organs, and who are having very serious sexual problems, but who have never had a provider, a physician, a surgeon, or anyone talk to them about these issues. And that, to me, is an issue of unfairness and one that motivated my work in this area. I do think it raises the question about what are essential medical services. And some would say that treatment of sexual problems is more elective or optional medical care, not maybe something that should be part of a basic package of medical care. And I might be amenable to that argument, but if you've had a sexual problem, or if you've had your breasts removed, or you've had radiation to the pelvis because of cancer, you might have a different point of view. And I think this gets to a fundamental tension in the question about allocation of resources and who decides what's health and who decides what's basic health care. Few physicians provide services around treatment of sexual problems because insurers and policymakers largely do not regard female sexual problems as medical problems. The common treatments used to treat female sexual problems, for example, moisturizers and lubricants that are pretty effective at treating vaginal dryness, very common problem among older women in particular, these products are regarded as cosmetic products. The FDA does not regard these as medical therapies, and therefore they're not subject to rigorous evaluation. On the other hand, thanks in part to Senator Dole, who was just mentioned, another link to the prior talk, male sexual problems, erectile dysfunction, for example, are considered medical problems. Insurance pays for the treatment of these, and there are a variety of evidence-based medical and even surgical approaches to address these problems. So my current practice is divided between the university, where I see a very narrow population of patients who've had cancer. I see patients, regardless of their ability to pay, if they've had cancer and they have these problems, they can come to see me there. But, of course, the vast majority of people with sexual problems, and the data would suggest anywhere between 30 and 40% of women at some point in their life have distressing sexual problems, are women who don't have cancer, fortunately, and who might not have access to health care that would cover these services. And so I share with you my personal experience, kind of the creative way that I've addressed caring for underserved women, because I think this is the norm rather than the exception. I think most physicians, like social workers and psychologists and other direct service providers, try to find ways to provide care to underserved people, and most of us feel motivated to do that. And so the way I've addressed this issue is by partnering with a major community-based organization that sees 100,000 patients a year in Illinois, that hasn't had the issue of female sexuality on their radar screen, and who has partnered with me to help train their staff to deliver these services. So that's how I can address this particular issue for a larger population. I'd like to spend more time caring for poor individuals. And I talk about myself, but maybe you can see yourself in this. I literally feel guilty on a daily basis when I come from the comforts of my home and come to Hyde Park and see around me people asking for money on the corner and people hanging by the liquor store during the day when they probably would rather be working. I feel guilty that I'm not doing more. I feel guilty about going to the comfort of my office in the ivory tower and really asking myself on a daily basis, am I doing enough? You know, the problems in Darfur bother me, but rather than go to Darfur, I'm looking at Connie because I saw her there, I go to an art exhibit about Darfur and buy the book and put it on my table and educate my students and colleagues when they come to my office. I wish I could have gone to New Orleans to help after the flood. These are the kinds of experiences that I think people who are in the healthcare professions hope to have, and yet for many, many reasons don't. So I want to just tell you a little bit about the personal pressures on the other side. So on the one hand, I aspire to take the talents I've been given and the gifts I've been given by society to get to this point in my career and translate those to good care for all people, regardless of ability to pay. And then on the other hand, I'm faced with something called a P&L. Who knows what a P&L is? Okay, well, thank you, because now I don't feel as stupid as I did when I found out. But my chairman called me to his office at the end of my first year on the faculty here and said, we need to go over your P&L. And, of course, I went down the list of possible acronyms that this could stand for. And what it turns out is that this is profits and losses. And this was a piece of paper that showed all the revenue I brought in and all of the losses I had accrued to the department. And I can tell you that the losses were better accounted for than the revenue in my mind. But the bottom line was that the bottom number was red, okay? And in part, this is because I'm an OBGYN. It costs $50,000 a year on average for me to practice a half day a week in outpatient gynecology, not even doing surgery. And it doesn't even allow me to remove a woman's intrauterine device. And so it's very difficult with a malpractice cost of $50,000 a year to generate revenue to offset that. And that's a reality of practicing in my specialty. And it's actually this issue of malpractice and torts and et cetera, that really hasn't been a big part of the conversation, but one that I think motivates and drives the way people make decisions. And there's evidence in the literature to support that. So I'd like to just take on the argument for a moment that physicians should not care for the poor. What would the world look like if physicians didn't care about poor people? What if there were major associations in medicine that stood in the way of public policy that would benefit the poor? Can we imagine such a thing? Well, let's look at the Hippocratic Oath. What does it say? It was written a few hundred years before the Common Era, maybe by Hippocrates or one of his consorts, and it swears to all of the relevant gods as witnesses at the time that I, quote, will care for my teachers and my teachers' children and pass the art of medicine to them. And it says, I'll always do the right thing for my patients. I'll never give a lethal drug to anybody. I will not engage in the pleasures of love with my patients, whether they're male or female, free or slaves, and that's about as far as it goes in talking about care for the poor. There really is nothing in the translation of the Hippocratic Oath that I've read that talks about care of the poor. Maybe that's because there was a different sense of rich and poor in ancient Greece that really was the difference between free and slave. But again, the only commitment to free and slave was to not have sex with either of them. So the oath is old, and maybe there are other reasons why physicians should not care for the poor. And for these arguments, we turn to the contemporary medical literature, where we see from Warren Ferguson in a 1994 book, It Just Ain't Fair, The Ethics of Healthcare in African Americans, where we identify many other reasons why physicians don't care for the poor. These include caring for the poor limits their capability to generate income and sustain their careers, and maybe some loss of prestige. And the description is, imagine a poor person coming to your plush private office and how this might be seen by the other patients. Physicians shouldn't care for the poor because they have difficulty providing adequate care. In the words of one California physician who participated in a focus group on this topic, quote, these people will pay for it, and these people will either tell you that they don't have the money to pay for the x-ray and they don't want to pay for it, and you're forced into practicing poor medicine. The inadequate care argument relates to the next reason doctors don't care for the poor, which is a worry about increased malpractice risk. And there seems to be a wrong perception by some physicians that poor people are more likely to sue. Others believe that they're more likely to be sued. There's more foundation for being sued because they actually believe they're providing poor quality care. And what does it mean to a physician who wants to care for the poor and who believes they have an obligation to do that, but not to be able to provide the quality of care they believe people deserve, and that's safe and that's effective? And I think that actually is a real issue. There's another explanation for why doctors don't care for the poor, and I think that this is really the dirtiest of the explanations, but it's, again, well documented in the literature. And this is under the category of patient characteristics or patient differences, and includes things like discomfort with the different language, culture, socioeconomic status, sexual orientation of patients versus physicians, and then things like even physical appearance, body odor, uncleanliness, or lack of gratefulness by patients who are poor for the care. One physician said, and again in this California article, you just don't get the positive feedback and reward for trying to make these people well because they can sabotage and destroy things. Usually not deliberately, but they're hard to work with, they're hard to help, and you get tired. This was in a focus group setting. Now, there were other comments that were to the contrary. I feel very gratified by caring for the poor. My patients are deeply grateful. But those both narratives are there. I just think it's a very uncomfortable thing to talk about physicians not being willing to care for poor people because of their physical characteristics. I find that somewhat revolting. But again, there's a literature to support this. There are some other explanations. Physicians feel overwhelmed by the enormity of the situation of poverty, confused about their role in the situation. And physicians, unlike clergy, are not typically selecting into medicine, nor are they groomed for an ascetic lifestyle. The cost of entry to medicine, even with societal subsidy, is high, and debts are a reality. For clergy, caring for the poor is a moral obligation. It feeds the spirit. For some physicians, caring for the poor is demoralizing. So how do we reconcile this, and what do we do? Well, I would like to say that there is another literature about why physicians ought to care for the poor. And this literature is rooted very much in something called the social contract. In social work, is the concept of social contract also a common theme? Yes, I see that. So what is the social contract? And I'm going to try to wrap up in the interest of time, but this is, I think, a really important place to go. The social contract is society says we need physicians with specialized knowledge to help keep us healthy. And they invest trust, number one, and I want to emphasize trust. It's like the Visa commercial, what's the price on trust? So they invest trust, they invest tax dollars, and society invests social support in the form of parents rearing children and public schools rearing students who are healthy enough and capable to enter into a rigorous professional practice. And then these students enter the academy. We have one across the Midway here. They become socialized into physicians. And then they go back to society. They have to ask the state for a license to practice medicine. And with that license, physicians then earn autonomy. They can choose where to practice, what to practice, and frankly, who to care for. And they earn self-governance. And we've talked about governance today. In order for physicians to deliver back on that contract, they're expected to uphold three principles: beneficence, do no harm, do good; respect for autonomy of individuals; and justice, which is the fair distribution of resources. Society expects these things, and society expects that if physicians act by these principles, they will, their health will be preserved. Well, so there's been a problem here, and the way that the literature, the medical literature, talks about it is that there are threats to, external threats to the integrity of the profession of medicine, and that these threats come from things like changes in technology, changes in the marketplace, things that actually, frankly, are timeless, and if I look over the last century of literature, those same external threats are repeated decade and decade again. The only new threat that I saw in the literature was bioterrorism, and how bioterrorism is a direct threat to caring for the poor, I think, is somewhat of a stretch, but maybe if we're diverting resources to security, we're diverting them away from care of the poor. So the social contract argument has only worked to some degree. In fact, some would say it hasn't worked at all. We've always had a social contract. Most people would say they know what it is, and yet poor people are still not getting the care that they need. So now what argument do we make? Well, the last 30 years, there's a strong argument in the literature that poverty is a cause of poor health. There's a medicalization of poverty, that poverty is a disease. And if poverty is a disease, then physicians ought to treat it, because physicians treat disease. And so that's really been at the level of public health, arguments about sanitation, vaccination, clean water, safe working conditions, that these ought to be provided in order to promote good health. Well, has that worked? Well, there's a strong literature that's convincing that in fact, poverty does relate to health. But again, we haven't seen a major shift in the number of we've seen a shift in the wrong direction of the number of poor individuals receiving health care. So in the last 5 to 10 years, something I think very interesting has happened in the narrative around physicians' obligation to the poor. And it's come in the form of moving the discussion from poverty as a disease to poverty as a pathogen. Now poverty isn't just something in the environment, kind of social context. It's actually something that gets under the skin of individuals to make them sick. And how have we come to understand this, focus on this hypothesis? Well, organizations, foundations like the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the National Institutes of Health have taken interest in this hypothesis. Can we understand the biological mechanisms through which poverty causes bad health, or through which a state of non-poverty promotes resilience to disease? And so in the last 5 to 10 years, I would say this has emerged in the time that I've had my academic career, we've started to see social scientists, people who, sociologists, demographers, economists, people who study individuals in vivo in their homes, take an interest in collecting not only self-reported information, but biological information about health. So, and as Harold mentioned, part of my work has been to design minimally invasive methods to collect the kinds of biological information that we collect in the clinic when we're studying health and disease in the hospital setting. So we can get small drops of blood from the fingertip. We can get saliva specimens. We can get vaginal swab specimens if we have a gynecologist on the team. And with this information, we can start to evaluate hypotheses about how it is that being poor alters the biology in such a way that one is more susceptible to disease. Now, if I had slides, I would show you a list of 20 grants issued by the federal government in the last month through stimulus money that would make use of this kind of data to evaluate this sort of hypothesis. And in my mind, this has been a major shift, and it incentivizes, really, for the first time, academics to start to understand the mechanisms, the pathways through which poverty results in poor health. So institutions are working on this. They're partnering with communities to study this in a way that they have not ever before. And as Harold mentioned, we're also doing this with something called the Southside Health and Vitality Studies. So I could certainly go on. I have more to say, but I, in the interest of time and opportunity for questions and conversation, will thank you very much. I want to thank Harold and Colleen for including me in this distinguished panel of speakers. I took a class here with Eddie Lawler when I was a student in the policy school, and some of the work that I've done that informed my comments today has been funded by the Center for Health Administration Studies, and I'm very grateful for that and for your attention. Thank you.
Questions? I have a question while people are thinking of their questions. Can you hear me?
I think these are off. Yeah. Or is there a switch on them?
Is there a switch? Well, I will yell. Or can I borrow that microphone? This is a question to Stacy. Yeah. Does it work now?
No.
They're unplugged.
I don't think there's any question that as individuals, physicians have a very high level of integrity. And in fact, when I think of the people that I know who are the most privileged who are actually helping poor people on a day-to-day basis, physicians rank pretty high. As participants in organizations and markets, physicians are not always animated by the same commitment that physicians have to individual patients. And we have lots of examples of very highly ethical people towards their patients who, in a system way, don't carry that as carry that same sense as managers and market participants. And the reality is a lot of the inequalities that we face in society, physicians bear witness to a lot of the economic inequalities that deny people access to care. And as individuals, they may respond in their practice in a particular way. But how can the medical profession be more effective in explaining and alerting the public and thinking about the way the medical profession does its business in a collective way to minimize those inequalities?
Thank you for the question. Now I'm aware I'm speaking on the behalf of the entire medical profession, which I'm certainly not qualified to do. But there is a literature that speaks to this too, and it comes to one of the nuances of my talk that I left out in the interest of time. A really important component of the social contract is trust. As I said before, the public invests trust in physicians, which allows physicians to accumulate autonomy and, frankly, power in order to practice in the ways that I mentioned. One of the key returns on that investment that society expects is altruism. And I just think it's an interesting, maybe a paradox. You know, can altruism be a deliverable in a contract between two parties? I'm not sure. How that relates to your question is that physicians, like all people, are driven in part by their own self-interest. And in their individual relationships with patients and in their organized behaviors with their associations or maybe in contact with their legislators, they're balancing what they know is good from a justice perspective versus what they know is good from an individual liberty and autonomy perspective. And unfortunately, I think it's fair to say that individual liberty and autonomy has largely weighed out. Physicians also think of themselves, and I didn't bring this with me today. I thought about what the implications would be. But a colleague of mine sent around a letter yesterday because he had read that geriatrics was going to move from the University of Chicago Medical Center to Holy Cross Hospital, a local hospital. And he wrote a letter to the provost and the board of trustees and everybody else, horrified that we would move geriatrics to out of the ivory tower into a community-based hospital. Well, what his concern was, he's a geriatric age person, and he's invested his life in the medical center, and if he gets sick, he wants to be cared for over there, not over there. This was not a justice-based argument. This is a self-interest-based argument. And those things are in tension from the medical student, you know, worrying about their grade and not advocating for their patient, to the practicing physician, to, I think, really most providers who are involved in an expectation of altruism.
I'd like to address this question of the potential role of altruism, and I want to do so initially from a stance of skepticism about the possibility of large-scale, purely altruistic motivation generating change. Some of you may be familiar with Kenneth Arrow's article from more than 40 years ago, Uncertainty and the Welfare Economics of Medical Care. And the basic pitch he makes, and he tells this in an ahistorical way, but I think you can retell it in a historical way, looking at the trajectory of medicine through the 20th century, is that, as he puts it, a commitment to otherness, a measure of a commitment, some commitment to not maximize wealth in the short term is, quote, part of the commodity the physician sells. That physicians make this pledge in order to achieve a measure of credibility. Now, you could see this as solving a kind of market for lemons problem. The Arrow story is that patients are uncertain about the value of treatment, and that uncertainty can be alleviated to some extent by physicians making this commitment to not be pure, you know, used car salesman type market actors. And physicians maintain a certain measure of credibility that way. And in other words, it ends up being a good deal economically for docs to be altruistic. But if you tell the historical story, things the historical story, I think, both supports this proposition and also gives us reason to worry. If you look back at the days of George Bernard Shaw and his play The Doctor's Dilemma, mocking doctors mercilessly for their avariciousness, snake oil salesmen, that period of time. And you have the story of the Flexner Report, cracking down on for-profit medical schools, cracking down on the profit motive, and doctors shrinking at medical school enrollments, adhering to affirming ethical principles that diminish the role of the profit motive, and perhaps a peak in the 1950s and early 60s of trust and credibility of the profession, perhaps trust beyond what was merited given the lack of data supporting what most doctors do. And then docs start getting greedy and start burning the seed stock. Maybe it begins with Medicare and the opportunity, the economic opportunity created by Medicare. There's a certain self-confidence about their trust in society. And then we see entrepreneurship emerging, growing, exploding in the 70s and the 80s. The clinics and the labs owned by doctors, the radiological equipment, et cetera. Once doctors seemed responsive to these incentives, it seemed kind of natural for managed care to just flip the incentives, right? Today we have maybe a kind of corrosion of what was built up by the movement that was begun with the Flexner report. But I do think you can tell a story about this ideal of altruism as market generated. And perhaps we will see, as doctors become concerned about their diminishing status in society today, perhaps we'll see a return to altruism on selfish grounds.
Questions?
I really take issue with the idea of altruism or charity care for people who are poor. Why is it altruistic to care for someone who's poor but not for someone who has money? It's insulting and demeaning to have to be in a program called charity care. I believe that everybody should be in the same pool and receive the same quality and the same access to care. And there are many doctors who often already don't care for the poor. In fact, about 22,000 people a year die because of lack of health insurance. And that number is from a couple years ago. I suspect that it's higher now with how much unemployment we have. In some parts of the south side of Chicago, the unemployment rate is over 40%. And the determinants of health, it is known that they are race and class. People want a single-payer program. 59% of people want it. 62% of doctors want it. And, you know, the argument that I hear most often from knowledgeable people is that it's not politically feasible. But, you know, that's what people said about the abolition of slavery, you know. And there is a growing grassroots movement. You know, there are demonstrations and rallies for single payer in every city, including this one. And I just wonder why, you know, this didn't really come up in any of the panels. It frustrates me.
I'm going to speak really briefly because I see my cap. But I think you've raised two really important issues. Now, number one, with respect to altruism, I think it's worth disentangling two meanings of the term. There's the idea of a certain measure of self-restraint when it comes to responding to economic incentives when you're seeing paying patients, right? That's the point that Kenneth Arrow was making, that the doc doesn't behave like the used car salesman. The doc holds off, doesn't order every possible test that will maximize revenue. In principle, that should be the goal, the idea is. But this assumes a paying patient doctor relationship, right? The other meaning of altruism that you're getting at is, of course, of charity, right? And not only do I agree with your point about it being potentially demeaning, there's also the reality that even if the doctor is altruistic in this second sense, the healthcare institutions, which provide resource-wise the great bulk of the care, right? Medical fees are only a small proportion of what we spend on healthcare nowadays in this country. Healthcare institutions, you know, need to find resources, and it's going to come from cross subsidies from paying patients. That's typically a regressive way of financing care because poor people spend a higher proportion of their income on health insurance, et cetera, than more well-off people. It's the first point. Second point on single payer. I actually think that single payer advocates today should be celebrated right now because the schemes that are at the center of Democratic debate, Democratic with a big D, Democratic Party debate in Congress with respect to health reform, create an unprecedented possibility for, and I tried to get at this in my talk, an unprecedented possibility for the emergence of single payer. Not by some grassroots reform movement with demonstrations. That's just not going to happen. It's against the thermodynamics of our political system won't let that happen. But through a mechanism involving a public plan that competes against private insurers within the insurance exchanges, and if the American people show a preference in the marketplace for that public plan, then the public plan will have economies of scale and will become more desirable and can emerge over time. And that's the only way we're going to get there, if we're going to get there. That's the only way we can get there over the powerful objections of the insurance industry and others. And so keep your eye on the fight ahead in the coming months over whether there will be a public plan included in the insurance exchange scheme. Because if you're a single payer advocate, that's the fight you want to win. You don't want to go out there and hold picket signs saying you're against any health reform unless there's a single payer plan implemented right now.
Can I just say one sentence, which is to say, I didn't use the term charity in my talk for the reasons that you point out, and I agree that with the point that you made. I also want to say you should be angry. I am too.
You know, I'm afraid we're a few minutes over, and which is my fault as the undisciplined moderator. Stacy has agreed to stick around. I think a bunch of single payer advocates will now be celebrating because we have some cookies and stuff for our reception. So if we could thank our panel. And, I do apologize to those of you that had questions that we filibustered, but you can come up and ask them now if you'd like.